How well do you know your literature history? Every Friday or Saturday, I send my sermon to my wife to review it. And this week, I decided that she needed to have a little quiz. And so I wanted to give you the same quiz. It amazes me how important opening lines are of different pieces of literature. And irregardless of how well-read you are, my guess is that you might be able to figure out which these books came from. Which books begins with, "It's a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." That is Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. This one, I don't know if you've read the book before, but I'll bet you remember the book. It was The Best of Times, It Was the Worst of Times, is of course Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. This one, I've never read the book, but I guess just from the topic, because the author does an incredible job of capturing the entire book when he says, "All children except one grew up." That, of course, was Peter Pan. And I have to agree with this author because this is one of my favorite books, even though I've never read it, because I watched the movie. And it was really good. The Princess Bride begins with this. And then one last book, it begins with, "If you are interested in stories with happy endings, you would be better off reading some other book." If you've ever read the series of Unfortunate Events, you'll remember that's the way it began. And actually, I have one more, because even though I don't believe I've ever read Moby Dick, I knew that it began with "Call Me Ishmael." But it's intriguing to me how important opening lines are. In fact, the best of authors are able to capture you from the moment they begin to put things down on paper. But it's not just authors. Speakers have to do that as well. Politicians or teachers or even preachers try hard to grab you at the very beginning. It's said that you never get a second chance to make a first impression. But it fascinates me how opening lines may be incredibly thought-provoking, maybe even controversial when they're shared, but later they just kind of lose their appeal. Let me throw one out there. My guess is that if you read this, 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth this continent, a new nation. I'm guessing most of you are taken, like I was, back to junior high when you had to memorize the entire speech. This, of course, is the Gettysburg Address. And when you read the 47 years ago, I'm afraid for most of us that kind of goes over our head. First of all, we don't talk in scores anymore. I had to go back and check and see how long a score is. A score is 20 years. But I don't think most of us get the controversy of that statement. The majority of the people in the audience in 1863 on the battlefield of Gettysburg, when they heard 47 years ago, would have said, "What are you talking about, Mr. Lincoln? I know that you're the president, but can't you add? Everybody knows our country began 16 years ago. It's obvious it began on September 17th, 1787. Everybody knows that." Do you know what happened on September 17th, 1787? That's the date the Constitution was signed. And for the first near century of our nation's history, the accepted beginning date of our nation was the signing of the Constitution, when the 11 colonies were woven together into a United States. It's true that the Declaration of Independence was important, but it was not seen as the beginning of our country until Abraham Lincoln, giving a speech on the battlefield of Gettysburg, recognized the Constitution said that African Americans were only 3/5 of a person. I need to go back to a document that views all people created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, such as life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Abraham Lincoln largely changed the beginning of our country. But because we are so accustomed to viewing the beginning of our country on July 4th, 1776, 47 years makes simple sense to us. May I suggest the book of Matthew begins with an even more controversial beginning. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ? Matthew, you have lost your mind. Everybody knows that Jesus is that illegitimate son of a common carpenter. We know that he grew up of all places in Nazareth. He was not the God promised, the long awaited King of Israel. I mean, after all, Matthew, we're still in bondage to Rome. How can you claim he was Christ when Rome still rules us? We're still slaves to Rome. If he were the Christ, we'd be free. You can't be serious, Matthew. Jesus Christ? That's nonsense. but because we have become so accustomed to the idea of Jesus Christ, I'm guessing most of us views Jesus Christ much like you view Dan Andrews. It's just his last name, right? No, it was an incredible assertion by Matthew that few in his world would have accepted. And thus, the remainder of the book is set out to defend that very assertion. Matthew is going to defend the reality that Jesus is, in fact, Messiah. He is the long-awaited anointed one of God. And his entire book is aimed at the defense of Jesus as king. And thus the question begins, how do you defend a statement that Jesus was king? You defend it with a genealogy, right? I think most of us fall in one of two categories when it comes to genealogies. When we come to a genealogy in the Bible, I think most of us either fall into the category of those who skip them entirely, or the second category, those who read them really, really fast and get to the next passage. I happen to fall into that category. I think the vast majority of us come to these genealogies, and I must admit they kind of go over my head. We live in a world where it doesn't really matter whose you are as much as who you are. But that isn't true throughout most of human history. In fact, for most of human history, it was far more important to whose you were than even who you were. Maybe you remember the miniseries Roots. It was written by Alex Haley. He was an African-American and went in search of his roots. And as he began to do his studying, he figured out that his great-great-grandfather's name was Kinte. But he really didn't know much about him, and so he began to study all about him. And as he began to study, he found out that he arrived at Annapolis, and he didn't know what that meant. Eventually, he found out that it was Annapolis, where many of the African Americans came and entered the United States. And as he went there and he did a great deal of study, he found out that his great-great-grandfather had come from the land of Gambia, which is a small nation on the western coast of Africa. So he went back there, and as he began to explore, he was fascinated that as he went into villages, he found many villages where the village elders would sit around the campfire at night and quote the genealogies. So-and-so bore so-and-so, who bore so-and-so, who bore so-and-so. And in one particular village, he was listening and it said, and so-and-so bore Kinte, who was taken from us and was never seen again. And he said it as if my life took a whole new meaning. Suddenly I recognized I had roots. And he wrote a book. For most of us, we might know our grandfather, we might even know our great-grandfather, but most of us don't take a great deal of time with the genealogies. And yet for a Jew, there were few things that were more important than whose you were. In fact, in first century Israel, if you desired to buy a piece of property, it wasn't enough simply to have the finances to buy the property. When you went to buy the property, you had to produce the money and produce the evidence that you were of the right lineage, the right heritage, the right clan, the right tribe to own that piece of property. And the only way you could do that is if the genealogies were kept. And in the first century, there was a huge amount of dedication just to the genealogies. It was important for buying land. It was really important if you wanted to be a priest. God had said only those of the tribe of Levi and the direct descendants of Aaron could be a priest. It was also incredibly important for a king. You had to prove that you were the son of David. It's interesting, in 70 AD, the Romans would go through and they would level the city of Jerusalem. They would destroy the temple. But one of the things that they did that has modern day consequences is they destroyed all of the genealogical records. After 70 AD, no one could ever prove they were of the line and the lineage of David. Messiah had to have come before 70 AD, or he couldn't prove he's a son of David. And thus, as Matthew begins, he begins in a way that was very typical, very normal, very much accepted to a first century Jew. He begins with a genealogy. This morning, I would like to read for you Matthew chapter 1, as it begins this way. Abraham was the father of Isaac. Isaac was the father of Jacob. Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Abinadab. Abinadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife, and Solomon the father of Rehoboam. Rehoboam the father of Abijah. Abijah the father of Asa. Asa the father of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat the father of Joram. And Joram the father of Uzziah. Uzziah the father of Jotham. Jotham the father of Ahaz. Ahaz the father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah the father of Manasseh. Manasseh the father of Ammon. And Ammon the father of Josiah. And Josiah the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the exile to Babylon. After the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel, the father of Abiud. And Abiud, the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim, the father of Azor, and Azor, the father of Zadok, and Zadok, the father of Akim, and Akim, the father of Eluid. Eluid, the father of Eleazar, Eleazar, the father of Mathon, and Mathon, the father of, thank you, some names I can pronounce, Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is the Christ. Thus, there were 14 generations in all from Abraham to David, 14 from David to the exile to Babylon, and 14 from the exile to the Christ. So what? Why in the world would we spend any time at all looking at a bunch of names that, first of all, I promise you, I didn't do a very good job of pronunciating. As I was listening to one of the pastors read it, he said, now this is the official pronunciation of all these words. That's not what I'm going to say. I know I butchered some of them. And the reality is that those from the exile to the time of Jesus, we don't even know who they were. We know nothing about most of them. What in the world could I possibly learn? Well, I would like to just kind of throw out three things. Is that, first of all, it's a royal story. Jesus is the son of David. It's fascinating to me. I'm not a numerologist, but the Hebrews were. In fact, it confuses me. If you go to the book of Revelation, as John is writing the end times, he will say that the number of the Antichrist is 666. Oh, by the way, you should know who that is. They were so accustomed to numbers and names being unique, linked rather, that they understood. And he assumed that you and I would figure out who 666 was. I don't have a clue. But it's fascinating to me that the name David, Hebrew doesn't have vowels. They put them underneath the letters. They only have consonants. It has three consonants. It has the Hebrew letter D, which is the fourth letter in the Hebrew alphabet, the letter V, which is the sixth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and again, the D. If you add that up, do you know what you come up with? 14. I think the point that he says there's 14 generations, there are more than 14 generations. If you go back and compare Matthew chapter 1 to the Chronicles, you'll see that Matthew leaves out generations. I think the point is he wants them to understand that Jesus is the son of David. In fact, that becomes one of Matthew's favorite descriptions of who Jesus was. He was the son of David. He was the one who was of royal birth. He had every right to sit on the throne. But even more than that, it's a real story. I'm afraid as we come to the Christmas story, our society has taken a somewhat true story and so fantasized it that we begin to look at the Christmas story as a story about a big fat guy who wears a red suit and has reindeer that fly with a red nose. The truth of the matter is that St. Nicholas lived. You can go back into history and you can read that there once was a plump priest who gave gifts out to children. But we have so fantasized the whole story that now we have reindeer that fly who have red noses. And if you talk to most kids, one of the first things they'll think about Christmas is Santa Claus. I fear sometimes we do the same thing to Christmas, that a baby born in a manger, a wise men showing up, that it becomes almost this fantasized story that we get so caught up in all of the details that we stop to forget it's a real story that Jesus really was born. Joanna Shelter was a lady who went to the Philippines back following World War II. She began to minister in a tribe that was unknown to the world, and one of her primary jobs was to first take their language, be able to record their language so that she could then take and write the Bible in a language that they could then read. It took decades for her to get to the point where she could get the Bible down into a language that they could read, but she had one gentleman, a tribal elder by the name of Amon, who was helping her along. As she was working on the translation, he got fairly familiar with English and got to the point where he could read English. And one day he came into her room, and on her desk sat a Gospel of Matthew opened. And he began to read the gospel, and he turned to her and said, "There's a genealogy." And she said, "Yeah, I know, they're difficult, they're hard names. Just drop down to verse number 18 and begin there." And he said, no, you don't understand. This is a genealogy. Is it a real story? We have our whole life been told that we came from the banana plant and a rock that got together and made people. You mean this is a real story? For the first time, he began to understand that Jesus was a real person. He went door to door in his village and said, "Look, Jesus is a real person. He has parents and grandparents just like us." And it made all the difference to realize that Jesus was real. Matthew was saying to his readers in that day, "I challenge you, go to the temple, check my genealogies. You will find that Jesus is in fact real. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a once upon a time. It is Jesus, the son of David." But more than anything, I am convinced that he shares the genealogy because it's a story of grace. In fact, if I could title this morning's sermon, I would title it "Grace in the Christmas Tree." I think one of the reasons why I don't really want to know my heritage is because I'm kind of scared what I might find. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Hitch. It came out in 2005, but it's a romantic comedy that my wife and I have enjoyed watching together. It stars Will Smith, and he's this modern-day matchmaker. And throughout the course, you see him put several couples together, but you also get this story of him trying to win the heart of a young lady. And on their first date, they go, of all places, to Ellis Island. I think part of the reason is we're scared of what we might find. We might have a butcher of Cadiz in our family tree, but so did Jesus. In fact, it's fascinating to me that Matthew does something unheard of in genealogies to a Jew. He includes five women. I challenge you sometime to go back and read through the book of 1 Chronicles. You will find chapter after chapter of genealogies. But you know what you won't find? Women. Matthew, on the other hand, begins, and at the very beginning, he first of all shares with us that there is this lady named Tamar. Now, if you can remember back to Sunday school, my guess is that you're going to have remembered stories about Rahab, Ruth, and Bathsheba. But you're probably not going to remember a story about Tamar because it's not exactly Sunday school ready. It's one of those stories that I'm kind of glad we stopped the book of Genesis before we got there. We ended in chapter 36, and we're going to pick it up again next year, and we're going to look at Joseph. But chapter 38 of the book of Genesis is this horrific story of Judah, Jacob's fourth son, is living in an incredibly pagan manner. In fact, he takes a pagan wife, and he gives pagan wives to his sons. And the first one he gives Tamar, and Tamar marries his oldest son and is unable to have children, and he dies. We don't know why, but the custom was such that if your older brother died without being able to produce children from his wife, you were obligated to go in and to produce children that would carry on his line. Well, Judah's second son refuses to do that, and God strikes him dead. And so she asks for the third, and Jacob says, "I'll give him to her someday." But she begins to recognize that he never will. And so she dresses up as a prostitute. And she goes and sits outside a pagan temple. And this is one of those topics that just kind of blows my mind. But history tells us that there was a time and place where it was believed the greatest act of worship was to go to a house of worship and hire a prostitute. That was the zenith of religious activity. Judah goes and he says, temple prostitute. Well, yes, I think I will hire a temple prostitute. And he goes in and he sleeps with Tamar, not recognizing her as his daughter-in-law. And she becomes pregnant. And as she becomes pregnant, the community soon finds out, and they are horrified. What a terrible daughter-in-law she is. She's become pregnant. Let's kill her. And Judah is orchestrating the execution of his daughter-in-law for a horrible act when she says, "Well, before you kill me, I just want you to know the father is the one who owns this ring and this staff, and they are Judah's." And Judah begins to realize that he is the father. And the product of that activity ends up in the line of Messiah. May I suggest the point of the story is this. God's grace is so great, it will and can forgive any sin you've committed. On more than one occasion, I've had somebody come into my office, and as we begin to talk, eventually the discussion goes to the question, I did X. I don't think God could ever forgive that. And I can go to the genealogy of Jesus and say, no, you don't understand. God's grace is so great that there is not a single sin that is beyond his forgiveness. I don't care what you've done. God can and will forgive. And Tamar stands as a permanent record in the lineage of Jesus that God's grace is so great it can forgive any sin. But we move from Tamar and we move to the second story. And the second story is one of Rahab. And let's be honest, Tamar just played the part of the prostitute once as far as we know. Rahab was a prostitute. It's fascinating. As you go back and read the story in Joshua, I would guess most of you are familiar with it. Joshua sends his spies into Jericho, the very first city that they will come across. And as they arrive there, they have to find some place to hide. And so where do they go? Well, they go where strangers wouldn't be out of the norm. They go to a prostitute's house. But I find it fascinating. Joshua doesn't make a big deal out of it. But as you come to Hebrews chapter 11, where you find Rahab in the hall of faith as one of the greatest individuals to have ever walked the life of faith, she is called Rahab the prostitute. I'm convinced the point is this. It doesn't matter what your life is. There is no lifestyle. There is no habit too strong that God's grace can't change. I know all of us have habits, have things in our life that we wish we could change. And we get to the point often where we begin to think, well, God will never change this. Rahab stands as this reminder that, yes, he can and he will. Thirdly is, I think, becoming my favorite story in all the Bible. Daniel's still right up there. I love the story of Paul, and yes, Jesus is everyone's favorite. But as you go to the Old Testament, I have fallen in love with the woman Ruth. Ruth is one of those books that is kind of situated in the back of the Old Testament. This last Wednesday in our men's Bible study, we're going through 12 different Bible study methods, and last week we were on the background of a book, and the guys decided, rather than trying to choose a long book, we chose the book of Ruth. And as I spent part of the week back in the book of Ruth, I was just reminded to the beauty of the story. It's a story about Ruth, who's a Moabitess. Moabites don't mean a whole lot to us because we're not Jew. We didn't live back before the time of Christ, but if you remember in Genesis 19, when God sends judgment to Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot flees, and his wife turns around, is turned to a pillar of salt, and only his two daughters leave with him. As they get up into the mountains, they begin to realize, well, Dad's not going to have any lineage. Let's get him drunk and have children by him. And so they get their father drunk in two consecutive nights. Both daughters sleep with their father, both become pregnant, and one of the children, as a result of that pregnancy, is Moab. Throughout the rest of the Old Testament, Moab is going to become this thorn in the flesh of the Israelites. Numerous times they raise their ugly head, and every time they're reminded that Moab is a cursed nation. As the book of Ruth opens, we find out that there's famine in Bethlehem, and so Naomi and Elimelech leave Bethlehem, and they go to, of all places, Moab, where they allow their sons to marry Moabitess girls. And in the first chapter, Elimelech, his two sons, die. And as the chapter 1 concludes, it concludes with Naomi returning to the city of Bethlehem. And as she does, all of the groups come out and they welcome Naomi. And they say, do not call me Naomi. Naomi means blessed when she says, call me Mara. Call me bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full. The Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? As chapter 1 ends, you are introduced to Naomi and Ruth, who have no hope whatsoever. There's nothing left for them. We talked when we went through the book of Ruth a few years ago that widow literally means one without a voice. She had nothing to her name. And yet in chapter 2, as Boaz allows Ruth to glean in his field, he begins to sense there's something different about her. And in one of the most beautiful verses in all of the Old Testament, he comes to her and Boaz says to Ruth, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Ruth had nothing but God. And she realized having God was all she needed. But what I find so encouraging about the story of Ruth is she doesn't accomplish any great tasks. She never slays a giant. She never parts a sea. She never does a single thing other than holding on to God with all her might. And God rewards her by allowing her to be in the very lineage of Messiah, to become the great-grandfather of Israel's greatest king until Jesus. He provides for her the hope that this life couldn't. My suspicion is that some of us this morning are struggling, trying to figure out what's the point. Life is hard. It's filled with pain and discouragement, and it's easy sometimes to come to the place where we begin to wonder, is there any hope? Go back and read the genealogies of Jesus and find the reality that Ruth, when she had nothing, found that God was enough. There's Ruth. God's grace can provide hope in any situation. And then finally, the fourth woman is not even named. It says, "And Jesse, the father of David, the king. And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah." Just a couple months ago, we were in 1 and 2 Samuel. Last year, I guess it was, we were in 1 and 2 Samuel, and we spent quite a bit of time on the story of Bathsheba. And I don't want to spend much time on it, but the point that really struck me from the story of Bathsheba is you'll remember that David and Bathsheba have a child, and as they have the child is born, and Nathan the prophet comes to David and says that your son will die, and David goes off, and he fasts, and he prays, and he begs God, "Please spare the life of my son." And God doesn't. But then a second son comes. And that second son will become the very next king. King Solomon is a result that God gave David a second chance. I think the reason he's there, or the reason she's there, is the fact that God does give second chances. I don't know about you, but I am so thankful that I get not just a second, but a third and fourth chance, because we blow it so often. We're out of time this morning, but the genealogies, I know they're hard, and I know it's really easy to skip over them, because for the most part, I don't know very much about most of them. And yet, in this incredible story of Jesus' birth, it begins with a list of four women that clearly show us that God's grace is sufficient for wherever and whatever you're faced this morning. Father, we bow in your presence, and I thank you for the genealogies. And Lord, I know that too often I skip over them quickly, and yet you've put them in your word for our instruction and edification. God, I thank you for Tamar, for Rahab, for Ruth, for Bathsheba. Lord, they certainly didn't live perfect lives, but they certainly lived lives that were filled with your grace. As we leave this morning and as we head back to the busyness of life and the busyness of this season, God, I pray that you would help us to enjoy the season, but that we would be reminded in the midst of the season of your amazing grace. Thank you for all that you have and all that you will do, for it's in your Son's holy and precious name we pray. Amen. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful afternoon.